This is the second part of a special about James Brown Productions in honor of the 75th anniversary of King Records and its important role in the musical heritage of Cincinnati. From 1965 to 1971, King Records on Brewster Avenue housed James Brown Productions, a music company which created a new genre of music, had many hit records, and was involved in the civil rights and Black Pride movements. James Brown collaborated with many local musicians during his recording career at King Records. During the next hour, you'll hear my conversations with Waddell Fowland and Jimmy Raley from the famous Flames, the Solars, and Bobby and the Expressions. Music historian Brian Powers talks with Dr. Kay Robinson, two of the Sisters of Righteous, Geneva L. Kennard Wood and Denise Kennard Crowley, and two members of the Damps, Dave Parkinson and Eddie Setzer. I'm Lee Hay, and this is James Brown Productions, Part 2, on WVXU.
This is Dale Fallon. I am formerly one of the Famous Flames, the Solars, Luther Bond and the Emeralds. I recorded 50 years ago at King's Recording Company. Our first record was All That Wine Is Gone. They don't do that no more. As a matter of fact, they don't do anything anymore like they used to. I also like to say that Cincinnati at one time had a lot of groups. And a lot of groups came through King's Record Company, for which I recorded, as the Solars and the Flames. It's pretty hard to describe everything when you're old like I am, you know. So I recorded behind Hank Ballard, James Brown. Let's see. We all grew up in the same neighborhood there and there. We also done recordings together and had plenty of fun doing that. So I guess basically what I want the world to know, and this is a good opportunity for me because it kind of gave me some pleasure, and maybe someday my great-grandson will know that his grandfather was an entertainer. I could tell you stories about King Record. Sid Nathan, Judy, secretary. She was a nice lady. She might be dead now, I don't know. The last I know, Judy was staying in Morwell Hall. Bobby and Expressions would consist of Jimmy, really, Bobby Davis, myself, just the three of us. We had a pretty good time doing that. We also went and took Bobby's name off, and we were the Expressions, and we'd done some things, too. However, it didn't really go over real good. At one time, the Sloop Time USA, Bobby and the Expressions, we wrote that song after we had done Sloop and Slide by Hank Ballard, which we were the background singers. Couple of the guys now still living. And, you know, as the Solars, it consisted of Delbert Gilliam, Bobby Davis, Jimmy Raley, myself, Waddell Fallon. We done this particular record on King. Bud Hopgood was the producing manager at that time. He was also one of James's manager. However, on the record, when it was released as the Solars, it was going over pretty good. Nobody Knows But My Baby and Me, and Here's My Heart, was done by the Solars. It was going over real good. However, James came to town. He heard it, heard what Bud Hopgood had done, and they pulled the record off the air. James didn't like the violins, some kind of way. So we redone it over as the Famous Flames. Therefore, Johnny Taylor, I think his name was Johnny Taylor, was one of the original Flames before we got the name. And he had a song he wanted us to do as the Flames. of Who Am I? So we done Who Am I, and the song was re-released, Nobody Knows But My Baby and Me, and Who Am I was on the other side of it as the Famous Flames. We done pretty good with it. We then come out with Stand Up and Be Counted, which we thought was going to be a very big hit. Everybody in the studio thought so. Even James thought it was going to be a big hit. But for some reason, the government men came in. When they came in, they shut everybody down. Therefore, I don't know what happened to the record, whether they released it or what. But anyway, it went over pretty fair. However, back to the Solars again. That was consisting of Delbert Gilliam, Jimmy Reilly, Bobby Davis, Wardell Fallon, and Delbert's no longer with us. Neither is Bobby Davis, which was like brothers. Getting back to the guys at King's, there's some still around. One works at VA Hospital. They were with the Crystals. And Bootsy Collins, Jimmy Reilly's still around. Today's music, you guys wouldn't stand a chance. I might be wrong, but they say this is a new day. This is Dale Fallon saying thank you for listening. Thank you. And remember all the old good songs.
Bye.
In the studio is Jimmy Raley, who's from Cincinnati. And tell us how you got into music.
Well, my older sister took me to see Nat King Cole. And I used to sit out on the grass when I was a kid and listen to the Mills Brothers practice on their patio.
You were telling me about Walnut Hills and what a hotbed for music that was in the 40s?
Yes. Well, you see, back in the time when all of the black entertainers couldn't go to hotels downtown, they would always come to the Mance Hotel, which was within walking distance from where we lived.
And you said you lived close to Otis Williams?
Yes, Otis lived right around the corner from me. We grew up in the same neighborhood.
And how'd you get into music?
Well, first with the church choir, then the glee club in school, and then singing with some guys I met in the service.
Now, yeah. This was in the 50s?
Yes.
And you were in Virginia Beach, and then you came back to Cincinnati?
Right. When I got out of the service, my cousin Bobby Davis, him and I got together, and we started singing a duet. And we recorded one of the first black line dances, The Stomp, in 60. At that time, we recorded our first record, not on King's, but on Fraternity Records when it was here in Cincinnati. And we couldn't get in to see Harry Carlson. So one day we just went down and we asked his receptionist which office was Mr. Carlson's. And she pointed to it and she asked us if we had an appointment. And we just walked away from her desk and we walked in Harry Carlson's office and closed the door and said, Mr. Carlson, listen. And we just started singing. And when we came out, we were under contract. And 3 weeks later, we recorded The Stomp.
And how'd that do?
It did real nice. It gave us work while we started traveling around with it.
You were at King Records before that?
No. Bobby and I were doing shows around Cincinnati. One of James Brown's business managers heard us sing, and he said he wanted to manage us. And so we got with him, and we went over to King. But Hobgood died, and so James took over our contract. And when he heard us, he changed our name from the Soul Horse to the Famous Flames, and we started working James Brown's Famous Flames.
And what year was this?
This was in the late 60s.
Did you ever work at King Records?
Hank Ballard and some other artists that, when they recorded, they would get in touch with me, Bobby, and another one of the guys who later we turned out to be the Expressions after we left James. When we left him, Sid Nathan heard us sing, and he said, with his big cigar and thick glasses, I want to make stars out of you boys. He heard us sing, and we were practicing to do some things behind Hank Ballard. And we were just down in the studio running through some of our stuff, get our voices ready. And Sid was up in the control room, and he heard us singing. And so Sid said, now, those boys sound so much like the Impressions. He said, let's name them the Expressions. We never had any hits that were really great, except for one, Stand Up and Be Counted and Out of My Life. That took off real good, and that's one that picked up in Europe that they played. And
what year was this?
I don't know just what year they started playing it over there, but a friend of mine, Cody Black, he had recorded with Kings also, and they had about 24 artists on this one record, different artists, and it was called Kings of Northern Soul, and Cody had a record on there, and we had a record on there.
Now, what was it like working with James Brown?
Well, James worked as hard in practice as he did on the stage. I guess that's one of the reasons they call him the hardest working man in show business. Some people found it hard to get along with James. One time I had a problem with him when we were doing a tour of Texas, and the manager made off with the money and left us in Texas. And we had to get back to Cincinnati the best way we could. And some of the band members, we had some younger guys with us, and their parents were over there at King's ready to perform because the manager had left everybody in Texas, in Dallas. Believe me, people that were working back in those days, they paid their dues.
Now, you said you were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yes, being with James Brown, yes. And it's great to finally get some recognition on my own besides just being behind someone out front.
Holding hands across the nation, more together now than ever before. Freedom right now, or else damnation. Freedom right now, and that's for sure.
Stand up.
United
together we'll make our stand. Divided we fall. Get up off your knees, brothers, sisters, to get your freedom standing tall. Someone else can do your part. Everybody's got a part to play. Right now we got to have freedom, not tomorrow, but today.
No more staying here in the ghetto, no more playing dead. I got a message here for all you people to hear every word I say. What we'll get it holding hands. Together just you and I, we got to have freedom.
My name is Dr. K. Robinson, and I was a recording artist for James Brown, King Recording Company in Cincinnati, Ohio. I think it was set in 1971. I was discovered by James. He just walked in a studio, and the engineer was listening to a promotional tape, and I got a contract out of that. And I have had tremendous breaks as far as being discovered because there was a Black music professor at Wittenberg University. And he played for the same church that I played for. I play piano and I train choirs. That's how I started. He heard me sing and offered me an opportunity for some vocal lessons. And it turned into something big. He trained me to sing some songs in four different languages, and I ended up appearing with symphony orchestras in the Springfield area.
One of the things I read about you is that you sing 3.5 octaves.
Well, yes, I started out that way, and I didn't know that was unusual. Just anywhere I wanted to go in the recording of a song, I could go. And, of course, when I did my first record, Amazing Grace, I couldn't figure out the end of the arrangement. And I looked at Roy Merriweather and shrugged my shoulders, and we were at the end of the song. That was the promotional tape that James Brown heard. But in the meantime, I just kept going up. And then when I got through, he said, you know, that's 3.5 octaves above middle C. And I said, okay. But it was very normal for me to, even now, it's normal for me to sing high, soprano, contralto, and alto. I have those three registers that I can sing very comfortably.
That recording you mentioned that you did, was that done at King Studios or somewhere else?
That was at King. I went down there with some friends of mine from Dayton. The guy that was the head of the group, the Galatians, he had a crush on me and he was trying to impress me. So he asked me to go down with him the following Thursday. I think that was on a Saturday that I sang at a banquet that he was at, and he sang too. He had a beautiful voice. And he said, would you like to see a recording studio? And I said, yes. So that Thursday, he picked me up. And when I got in the car, I realized, I don't know this man, but we did go to King Recording Company. And while I was there waiting on his group to get together, the engineer, Ron Menhoff, asked me to sing. And I thought he was talking to somebody else, but there wasn't anybody else in the studio behind me. So I had been working on this song, Amazing Grace. It's two songs, two old songs. They're public domain. That means they were over 100 years old. So therefore, you didn't have to worry about the copyright. And I took those two songs, put them together, and I couldn't figure out the end of the song, but I had practiced up to a certain point with Roy Merriweather, and I just went on and started singing. When I got to the end of the song, I ended up going up and up and up and up, and come to find out I had hit 3.5 octaves above middle C, which is kind of phenomenal. And that sold that record across the country. Now it's a legendary song, I Should Be Rich, but somebody heard it and King Recording Company did not copyright it. They should have copywritten the arrangement that I made, which is just like writing a song from scratch. But they didn't do that. And Reba Rambo heard it and checked the rights on it and saw that it wasn't covered. She made $7.5 million off of it the first year that she released it. And it broke my heart. By that time, my marriage was broken up. I had 5 small children, 16 months apart. I really needed that money. And she met me. We were catching planes out of Nashville. And she recognized me and told me she heard me on Randy down in Nashville, Tennessee. Or somewhere, no, down in Florida, wherever she heard it, she checked the rights on it next day. It wasn't covered, and she put it in her name. She had no shame, no guilt, and she took that song and put it in her name, and now it is legendary. She told me then that she lived out of the checks from 28 nations, 28 countries, that's what she said, out of her mailbox. She got 28 checks a month paying the royalties on that song. That was heartbreaking.
One of the musicians that heard your voice was James Brown. How did you find out that he was interested in you and having you record for James Brown Productions?
Well, that same song that I was talking about, that was the record that I was asked to record by Ron Linhof. And he was editing that song the following week. And James walked in the studio at King, heard my voice, and said, "Who is that?" And Ron said, "That's Kay Robinson from Springfield." He said, "I've never heard a voice like that. Call her and see if she wants a recording contract." But I did not see him for 2 years. He was traveling. He was overseas. And he had people like Bud Hopgood and Speedy. He handled the contacts with musicians, and we had parts of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra that did some background work. Mr. Brown put his money into producing it. It didn't cost me a dime. He flew me in from Dayton to Cincinnati. The plane would go up about 12 feet and then come right back down, but he would fly me in to do my sessions. And then Ron Linhof was the engineer. Then Bud Hopgood was his production manager. And Bud took care of all of his business. And then we had Speedy, who told me what to do, what Mr. Brown wanted, what he expected. And he set me up on the road to learn production. I learned how to produce. He taught me promotion. That's what James taught me before I met him. And he sent me to every radio station that played rhythm and blues and gospel in this country, from coast to coast. And I have a personality. I like people. And if you like people, they'll usually like you, you know. And the guys would have such a good time. Well, then when I would go in one station, the A&R men or the talk show hosts, they would call the next city that I was going to and say, "She's on her way." Then they would say what I looked like and everything. And then when I got there at the radio station, they'd be all dressed up, ready to take me out. And we'd go out and eat at the best places. This was James' way of promoting me as a gospel singer. When my album came out, they all knew me.
I think that this might have been the only gospel album that James Brown put out under his company at King.
Well, he had to establish a company because King would not record me. they did not have any administration for gospel music. They didn't have, you know, a production department. They didn't have any of that. They didn't have any A&R men who could come in and produce you and record you. They didn't have any of that. So James said, well, I'll set one up myself. Well, when he did that, he got all the money. He got total control of everything that I recorded. And I'm sure if he found somebody else, he was going to record somebody else on that gospel label.
A lot of these songs on your album did get airplay in a lot of different markets around the U.S. And some of these songs and these albums were being played on radio stations throughout the South.
Well, this is true. Lord, Let Your Will Be Done hit in Little Rock, Arkansas. And then I Found the Lord. That was big up in the Boston area. But down south in Little Rock, Nashville, Tennessee, Louisville, Kentucky, Tampa, Florida, Macon, Georgia. Now, that's where James was from. So there's a whole lot of church activity down there, and they just played it to death. I sung it all over this country. And everywhere I would sing it, when I would start it, I would sing one like, Lord, I'm Yours. And I would hold that a long time, and then the house would go out. And I would have to wait 5, 10, 15 minutes until they calmed down. It would just tear up everywhere I went because they played it on the air so much. He blacklisted me. When I wouldn't go into rhythm and blues, he shut me down. He told me, I'd cut you as an artist, a gospel artist, to see if people liked your voice. So when he asked me to switch, he said, now I gave you what you wanted, what you were after. He said, now I want you to switch to rhythm and blues. And suddenly I saw all of this wealth, and the sky was the limit for me. So then he prophesied to me and told me that he said, you're going off the scene and you're going to come back. And he said, I'm going to release everything I ever cut on you. Well, I haven't come back yet. I'm just now coming back. But it has been released. After he died, they released everything I recorded for him and made bukus of money. They're selling the albums as I speak. So he was a tremendous seer.
So Henry Glover worked with you on that song, This Old World, that he wrote?
He wrote that song for me. He listened to my voice in the studio and wrote that song for me, put it on tape. And Mr. Brown wanted him to write a song for me. And that was as close as I could come to the title of the album, We Need Time, This Old World, We Need Time. And after the album was released, he was making the money and we didn't talk anymore. Because after I told him I couldn't go into rhythm and blues because it just wasn't in me to do that, he dropped me like a hot rock and banded me across the country from recording for anybody.
But now you're back to recording.
Now I can record anything I want to record.
How he made us all. From the same old reason, old clay. Same old clay. He made us all. Same old clay. He made you and me.
I'm Geneva Wood, and I'm one of the members of the Sisters of Righteous.
And I'm Denise Kennard Crawley, and I'm also a member of the Sisters of Righteous with the James Brown Productions at King Records.
Now, you two happen to be sisters. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit of how you guys started doing music together?
We started in the church choir, and my mom, who was the pianist for our church till the day she died, and Gigi, my sister, she also played for the younger choir. So that's how our singing began, and there was a gentleman at King Record Company. His name was Gene Redd. Gene Redd was the one that heard us and wanted to take us to King. He heard me. Roberta was leading a song. I was leading a song. Gigi was playing piano. He knew we were all related, mm-hmm. and he took us to the King Record Company. And Gene really brought us there as his group.
Yeah, he kind of worked as a musical director for King
Records. Arranger. And
what church was that?
El Bethel Baptist Church. It was on Eastern Avenue, which still exists, but it's not in the same location.
So when Gene approached you and brought you over to King, what vision did he have for you guys of what you could do?
Well, he knew it was a recording studio where there was a lot of music being written there. It needed background vocals, and he wanted us to do background vocals, plus he wanted us to start singing things that were written for us. And he knew that we were always singing at home and writing our own stuff. So that's what his plans were.
About how old were you guys at that time?
Teenagers.
I was a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. Gigi was
17 or 18.
Gigi was at,
I think it was my first year at CCM.
And Roberta was a senior in high school. You know, after we were there at King for a short time and James Brown heard us, he told Gene that he wanted our group. He didn't really ask him. He told him that since he had his own productions there. We didn't have a name at that time.
No, we didn't.
And so James gave us a name.
So he's the one who gave you the name Sisters of Righteous.
Yeah, we had a short conversation with him about the tense of righteous or righteousness because we were still in school, in an English class and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And James said, no, the Sisters of Righteous, not the Sisters of Righteousness.
So there you have it.
And you guys, in addition to doing background vocals for other artists, for like Charles Brown and
Hank Ballard, Vicki Anderson,
and Wayne Cochran. But you guys also recorded material that you actually wrote yourselves, too.
Well, the first one was That's How I Feel. We kind of put that song together. It might have been in the attic or on the second floor of my grandparents' home. We had no piano or anything like that there, but we had a sense of harmonization. Let's see, Roberta may have written the lyrics, and I would put the music to it. They ever argued about anything.
And that's what made it so good is because we could get together and Gigi, even though she's not telling you, but Gigi had been taking piano for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
Ever since she was a little bitty girl.
Nine. And, at Wurlitzer Music Studio, which is, I don't think that exists anymore.
Downtown?
Yeah.
Downtown.
On 4th Street?
I'd get on that bus and that's my morning activity.
How did you adapt to working in a recording studio? What was that atmosphere like for you guys?
It was great.
We felt good about it. We were young, and
James Brown actually came to our house.
He did.
Before we signed any kind of contracts with him or anything, and he brought his entourage onto our street in East End.
He sure did.
And
El Dorado.
He came in the house and met my dad, and my dad's name is also James, and so they shook hands, and then he promised my dad that when he would take us into the studio, he would really look after us, and nothing would happen to us. He wouldn't let anybody bother us because we were still teenagers. And that is what he did. You know, when we went to the studio, they would call us at like 10 o'clock at night. And my mom and dad were always into homework and school. So that's another thing. You know, they made it clear to James Brown that this would not take the place of us going to class
getting our
the
education.
Next day.
Yeah,
so we'd go to the studio at 10 o'clock at night, maybe not be finished until 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And we had to make sure our homework was done. We had to make sure that we got up on time, that we got to school the next day.
And sometimes we'd come after the instrumentals laid all their tracks down, and then we would come back in and put things over them. And that's when we had a chance to adjust some of the things that we were doing. If James wanted more of what we were doing in another spot in the song, he would be up in the control room. He kind of directed everything, and even though they had the engineers, he was in control.
And he really liked the fact that Gigi had a, you know, musical background, and she was in CCM, and she knew how to write music. Because a lot of times what they would do, they would send the dub. I don't know if you've ever seen those old-time dubs.
Heavy.
Yeah, it looks
like 33s.
A piece of metal. It was just black piece of metal. It had the song on it, but it wasn't all mixed and engineered and everything. And sometimes he would send that home with us and tell us that he wanted background for this song. And so he knew that Gigi could write mm-hmm. music. So we would go home and we'd...
He'd trust me.
Yeah. And we'd sing and make up music to it, and Gigi would put it in writing, and which made it even better for the studio band when the studio band would come in and even make it even fuller sound.
James Brown Productions had another CCM alumni at that point, and that was David Matthews.
Dave Matthews. Mm-hmm.
Did you guys work with him much on sessions at King?
Yeah. Dave Matthews was really the one that ran that engineering room. He was just amazing. He really was.
I was curious who was playing your music on the radio.
WCIN played most of the time our stuff. You know, that was back in the day when...
They paid people to play things. So I don't think they paid to play our music because we kind of would hear about things, you know. And at one point in time, someone let us know that Mr. Brown, James Brown, would come in and he'd have his entourage. They would pay the radio station to play his, not play ours, but to play his, because we were more popular in our own city. And he didn't want us to become more popular than he was. So they kind of paid so that his would be played a little bit more than ours.
He wanted to stay on top. And I understood that because when we got to the studio as teenagers, we were the only people in that studio that he allowed to call him James.
Yeah, right.
Everyone else, he made them call him Mr. Brown. So we were just enjoying ourselves. We weren't doing it for the money because there was no money, really. Every background song we did, we only got paid $20 to do a background song.
Do you have any stories about Hank Ballard or recording with him?
Yeah, that was back in the day when blacks wore what was called a process.
He had that big song.
So we were there when Hank made that song. How are you going to get respect when you haven't cut your process yet?
Right.
That was during time period where James Brown changed his process to an afro.
Yeah, I found a Jet magazine where they actually had the before and after photos mm-hmm. of James when he did that.
We were fortunate enough to be there to hear all the talk about it and when it was being done.
Mm-hmm. Are you singing on that song? Is that one of the ones that you
were... We spoke on that, yeah. We just say, how are you going to get respect?
Yeah, we didn't call it singing.
When you haven't cut the process yet. We had to repeat that. So there were a lot of repetitive things, too, uh-huh. that you hear in the recordings. I think he was kind of like a precursor to rap when he had a lot of us call and response.
And his really well-known song, I'm Black and I'm Proud,
you know.
Everybody in the studio, he pulled them in the studio room and we recorded that background on there. I'm Black and I'm Proud. And then James said, it's not full enough. We need more sound. We need more voices. So that's when they went out on the street on Brewster Avenue, pulled in a lot of kids to add to a lot of the people that were already in the studio trying to make that a full background on that song.
James Brown had his own section of King Records in the building. He had his own suites and office. Right. Did you guys ever go in his office? Because I always heard a rumor that, you know, everything in the bathroom had some gold to it or something like
that. Yeah, his office was,
it was
very
exquisite.
Different from the rest of King Records Company. And when Dwight Tillery was talking about trying to keep that building alive as a historical site, and we all walked through there, and James walked into his office, and some of his stuff was there, and some of it was gone, but it was still looking like James's office. And James wanted to know who took this, that, and the other that was gone. He wanted to know where it was and who had it.
Did you guys have a sense that King was closing near the end? Did you get a feeling for that?
We did, and I think partly because, number one, James wasn't coming around anymore. He would call us. And I wasn't even sure whether he was trying to develop his own studio somewhere else, because I knew he had a radio station in Augusta.
Well, he was really kind of struggling himself after, you know, his big production thing at King. he still wanted to be out there, but he never really had another studio that really made it like his production company over here at King Record Company.
He was very hot at that time at King, you know, and when you guys were there, he did so many number one hits.
If you look at all the number one hits, if you heard something on there, if you heard us singing or yelling or screaming or back and forth, we were there in the studio with him doing that. So we had a chance to explore a lot of different avenues with him in that way.
And the whole experience was just an unforgettable experience. I'll just put it that way. And we're really fortunate to have done that.
When he's in town, I search for you. That's when I hear him call my name. Oh, 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 oh. Sometimes I wonder if he really loves me. Whoa, I just don't know.
This is Dave Parkinson. I was associated with James Brown during the late 60s. I'm a saxophone player, and I recorded it on several things at King Studios with James Brown Productions.
Well, Dave, as I understand, you were in a band called The Daps, but before you were called The Daps, you were another band, a live band that would play around Cincinnati. Can you tell me about that band and who was in that band?
Yeah, we were a popular band in the Cincinnati area called the Cincinnati Kids, and we were the house band at the Inner Circle, which is now Bogard's. And Troy Seals and Joanne Campbell headed up the band, and I played saxophone, and Les Ash was the other saxophone player, and Eddie Setzer, we called him Fat Eddie, was the guitarist. Tim Heading played keyboards, and Tim Drummond played bass with us for a time, although Troy Seals was our bass player. Well, he doubled on bass and sang a good amount of that time.
And I think you had a couple of different drummers play in the band.
Yeah, we had Ronnie Grayson played drums with us, and we had two or three different drummers. Doug Huffman, who lives in Indianapolis now, played drums with us when I first joined the band. I don't recall any other drummers. A good friend of ours was Bo Dollar, but Bo was more of an entity to himself, and he never actually played with the band.
Yeah, I see his name associated with the Daps. I wasn't sure. I don't think he was a live drummer with you guys, but I thought maybe he did some recording with you guys at King.
He didn't necessarily record with us at King that I remember, but I know he did some recording for James. Bo was a big part of the music scene around the Cincinnati area. He was a really good funky drummer and a great singer.
How did the Cincinnati Kids get involved with James Brown?
I think James just started coming around the Inner Circle. Of course, that was a big thrill for all of us. And he started to sit in occasionally with the band. That was about the time Cold Sweat and There Was a Time, and it was about that era, 67, 68, I guess. And James became interested in the group. That was a kind of a delicate time racially, and I think James thought it might behoove him to become involved with white groups similar to ours.
Yeah, you guys were a white band doing R&B music. You were doing soul?
We did a lot of soul, and we did pop covers, too. But the rhythm and blues and soul was pretty much our forte.
You guys were the Cincinnati Kids, but then you became the Daps. Was there a story behind that?
That would have been after we became disassociated with Troy and Joanne. And actually, James tagged the name The Believers on us. That was our first name with James. And we eventually turned into the Daps.
Somebody told me that Troy Seal and his wife, Joanne, already had a record deal, and so they couldn't sign with James Brown Productions.
That's quite possible, yeah. I'm not sure what label that would have been or what record deal.
Now, you guys recorded and had things released as the Daps on the King label, on the James Brown Productions, and one of them was There Was a Time and another song, Rabbit Got the Gun. Do you have much memories about recording those songs?
I remember being in the studio till all hours of the night, end of the morning. Those would have been a couple of the tunes we spent a lot of time on. I remember myself recording an old standard called Honky Tonk.
Are you talking about the Bill Doggett song?
Yeah.
Now, you guys were backing Martha Whitney and Hank Ballard, and I think you might even go on the road with Hank Ballard.
Yeah, we were on the road with Hank for a couple of weeks. We had a 2-week stand at a club in Atlanta.
How you gonna get respect? You haven't touched the profession. How you gonna get respect? You haven't touched the profession.
Now, first of all, my soulful brothers, you can't be someone else. You're black and you're beautiful. This I know, just being your natural self. So get that mess out of your hair. My dear life, respect gonna come to you. All right.
How you gonna get respect? You haven't touched the process yet.
Sing it, sister, sing it.
How you gonna get respect? You haven't touched the process yet.
And I think we may have did a thing with Bobby Byrd, too. There was Marva Whitney, and I think there may have been one or two more female vocalists, but I don't recall their names right now.
Well, maybe Vicki Anderson?
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, she was recording with James Brown Productions at that time. Now, one of the songs that the Daps backed up James Brown, I don't think people realize that, is a song called I Can't Stand Myself, which became a big hit for him.
Yeah, that was just a quartet. That was Eddie Setzer and Tim Heading, and I think probably Ronnie Grayson was the drummer on I Can't Say for Sure. Although we got credit and got paid for the session, he decided not to use horns on the session. And then there was always a Kunga player, and I don't recall his name, but James always used a Kunga player on just about everything he did. It was subtle, but it was a big part of his sound.
Well, you had Les Ash, who was also a saxophone player in the band. How did you guys work together, having two saxophones in the group?
Oh, we had a pretty good marriage. We played well together. We were at a place in Seaside Heights, New Jersey. I don't recall the name of the club, but Les was from Asbury Park, and he happened to be in town one night with his horn and sat in with us. And Joanne and Troy were pretty enamored with Les, and Les was looking for something to do. By the time we got back to Cincinnati, Les was a permanent member of the band. We were in Seaside Heights for, I think, 10 weeks. The Beachcomber was the name of the bar. And as the Daps, after we became disassociated with James, we were the house band at a place called the Lions, something or other.
Oh, I think it was the Lions Den in Dayton.
Yeah, I believe it was. And we were there for about a year under the leadership of a guy named Jelly Roll, Roger Troy.
Once you got tired of the road, you opened up your own barbershops in the mid-70s. I mentioned your barbershop because there was a guy in town that the Daps were friends with, a guy named Jerry Lay.
Yeah, he had a barbershop in Clifton. And he did James's hair for quite a while, about the whole time we were involved with James. And occasionally James would take Jerry with him on jobs to do that wild do James always had. And wanted to get a plug in for Bud Hobgood because Bud was a big part of the organization. James is a personal manager, and I think to this day that if Bud was still alive, James would be also. He was a sharp and pretty clever guy.
Yeah, he died fairly young. Do you remember when that happened?
Yeah, I think it was maybe before 1970, and James was kind of known for saying, "Good God," like a little ad-lib phrase he used. And Bud came up with the thing, "Good God, $1,000. That was coined by Bud.
He booked a lot of the studio. You see his name in a lot of the credits on King Record albums. So I'm assuming he must have been present when you guys were recording at the studio.
It was always there. His office was there.
And I was wondering, how did you guys part ways with James Brown Productions? Was there a reason for that, or was that just sort of a natural progression?
Well, natural progression is a good way to put it. It turned out to not be a great career move. We didn't make a whole lot of money. It was a lot of fun and kind of a bragging point to be involved with someone like James. And he took us to New York where we did the Merv Griffin show. We played Madison Square Garden with, I think, Count Basie and Slappy White, and a couple other people were on the bill. And he rented a limousine and took us to the Apollo Theater. And that's when little Johnny Taylor and Joe Tex and a couple other people were playing there. And he had put his father up in a beautiful house out in Manhattan. And he took us there that night. I remember he got us all together and kind of gave us each what he thought our role was in the band. And that night he told me I was the musician in the band, and that was a great compliment. He said Les was also a great musician. He had a good business head on his shoulders.
I tracked down your guitar player, Eddie, and he told me that you were the good-looking guy in the band, and you would attract all the women to the shows.
I don't know about that. A little bit about Eddie after the Daps. By that time, Troy had moved to Nashville, and Conway Twitty had pretty much taken Troy under his wing. And Troy turned out to be a great songwriter and producer. He did I've Got a Rock and Roll Heart for Eric Clapton and several tunes for Conway Twitty. And Eddie and Troy collaborated on Seven Spanish Angels by Ray Charles, and I had scribbled down a few words to something, and Troy helped me finish a tune that was later recorded by the Oak Ridge Boys called But I Do. It was on their Room Service album. That would have been in 71, and I still get small royalty checks.
My name is Eddie Setzer. I played for a group called The Daps, which was affiliated closely with James Brown Management. It was hard to believe that we got $45 for, like, you know, 3-hour sessions.
So, Eddie, one of the songs that you guys backed James Brown was a song called I Can't Stand It. What are your memories about recording that song with James Brown?
James had a jazz record. He changed it up some. There's no way you would have known it was the same song. Kenny Burrell, I think.
Did you kind of jam on that song? Or how did you guys work out the recording for that song?
We listened to the record, and James said, we want to start to do this. And when he starts doing things, his arrangements are put together. He always does the drums first, then the bass, and he gets the groove going, then he'll do the guitars, and then, you know, the horns do their thing. The keyboard works in there somewhere. You get the groove going, and you just keep playing it. You know what I'm saying? If you don't stop and let other people get their stuff down, and you just keep going.
Now, that was a big hit for James Brown.
When you text me,
Another song I wanted to ask you about was a song, I think it's maybe a tribute to you. It was an instrumental called Fat Eddie. I guess that's you.
It was.
You guys did some recording with Hank Ballard and Martha Whitney, too, for James Brown.
Yeah, Hank Ballard, Martha Whitney. We did a couple of things with Vicki Taylor, I think it was Bobby Bird's wife. I think we did a couple of things that he did.
Well, I wanted to ask about what kind of guitars you were playing that time on these sessions.
I played a Telecaster on one. A lot of times I played a Gibson ES-335, double cutaway, semi-hollow body. Toward the end, after we became the Daps, we get box equipment and boxed indoors in, and so we got box amps. I didn't like it that much, but I played them because, you know, he wanted me to.
Now, you guys would play around town, and wouldn't James Brown show up on some of your sets sometimes and join in with you guys?
Yeah, once we started working for him, we sure did, yeah.
One place that you mentioned, there was a bar down on Walnut Street downtown, like in the basement.
The basement of the old Metropole Hotel. It was called The Trip when we played there, and one time it was Tommy Helms' good dugout. Tommy Helms was a good second baseman, played for the Reds back in the day. He opened that club. It was one of the first clubs that had discos and disco dancing, girls in cages and all that stuff. So we used to take a break from the Angel and walk over and watch the girls dance and come back and play.
So you became a pretty well-known, successful songwriter in Nashville later in your career, but one of the first songs that got recorded that you wrote was at King.
It was What Kind of Man, and Marvin Whitney cut it, and we thought, wow, this is cool. Me and Troy Seals got together, and he came up with some more words to it. I had a good guitar lick, and I had a title, and that was pretty much it. We were in the studio and recorded it the same night that we wrote it, so 6 months later, we got a check for it. That was actually the first song we ever wrote together, really.
So what became of the Daps?
He kept planning this. This is Bud Hopgood, too, and I'm not blaming James. He kept saying, we're going to make all this money, and it's big money, and we thought we were doing pretty good. But he put us on a retainer, and the guys didn't like it. And Hank Ballard came and told us, he said, you guys ain't going to make any money. He said, you're going to get paid the same thing. You're going to get one. So he made us, everybody got mad, and this kind of blew up.
You've been listening to a special in honor of the 75th anniversary of King Records about James Brown Productions. I'm Lee Hay, host and co-producer, along with Brian Powers. Technical assistance from Andy Balterman and Michael Grayson. You can hear more information about King Records at WVXU.org. You've been listening to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.